Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 16th, 2006, day before St. Patty's Day. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week we head down to Austin, Texas to talk about hot side aeration. We assemble an expert panel to take a look at Brian Warren's hot side aeration experiment. We discover some very surprising and interesting results. Well, it was great to be in Austin for a few days. My good friend Kelly Dodson and I went to the Interactive Conference at South by Southwest, and I also got to drink some beers that aren't available here where I live here in Northwest Arkansas. So it was good to get out of town and learn a bunch of stuff and discover some good beers. While I was away, the email didn't stop coming, and I tried to keep up with it as much as possible. I apologize if I lagged behind lately. I blame all the good IPAs and the Mexican food. Bill in Windham, Vermont, wrote in to ask for some input. Bill says, any advice for doing double batches besides doubling the ingredients and getting a second plastic fermenter? I know I'll need a bigger burner, Bill says. Well, I'm assuming Bill means stepping up from 5-gallon batches to 10-gallon batches. We've been talking a lot about smaller batches lately, and it's a good change of pace to talk about scaling up for a change. Well, when you double your batch size, you'll obviously need a bigger brew pot, and I recommend a bigger burner, too. As Bill mentioned, it's hard enough to bring 5 gallons up to boil on the kitchen stove, let alone 10. You'll also want to look at whether you'll want to upgrade your wort chiller. For instance, in the summertime, it takes a pretty long time for me to bring 10 gallons to pitching temperature using just an immersion chiller and water from the tap. You might want to look at counterflow chillers or even more sophisticated chilling solutions. You'll also need twice the amount of yeast, so you could make a double-sized starter and split it between a couple of 5-gallon fermenters, or you can use the opportunity to experiment with different yeast strains. You can put a different yeast strain in each fermenter and see how the beer is different in the final product. For instance, one time I made a double batch and pitched California ale yeast in one half and English ale yeast in the other, and it was interesting to see the subtle differences between those two. And of course, with twice as much beer, you'll need twice as many bottles or kegs to store it when it's done. And you'll also probably make twice as many friends when it comes time to drinking all that homebrew. Tim in Denver writes, I'm an extract brewer, but I do recipes that call for a pound or two of grain to be held at a certain temperature pre-boil for a certain number of minutes. My question, does that process make me a mini masher or a steeper? Well, Tim, it depends. If you're using base malts as a part of your grain bill and holding them at a sacrification rest temperature to convert the starches into sugar, then you're a mini masher. If you're just using specialty grains and simply soaking them in the water, like tea in a tea bag, to get their color and flavor, then you're a steeper. It's basically all about whether you need to convert starches to sugar using the enzymes that are in the base malts as a result of the malting process. I hope that makes sense. You may remember Damon from Highlands Ranch, Colorado, who wrote in a while back asking for listener input on using a brew belt to keep his beer warm while it ferments in his chilly house during the wintertime. Well, Damon writes in with a follow-up. He says, about the brew belt, the temperature was fine, and when I racked it to the carboy, the gravity was perfect. I get to bottle it tomorrow, so I'm excited, Damon says, but I am wanting to wait for 4 weeks to try it because I don't want to open a bottle too soon. Boy, that's going to be tough. I started on another beer on Saturday, a Blue Moon clone, and it's been active with the brew belt since Sunday, but it has a higher starting gravity. Damon says, in short, I give the brew belt, so far, 2 thumbs up. It keeps the temperature in the right range, even in our cold weather. Well, that's good news. I also have some more good news. The all-grain DVDs are here in the studio, fresh from the replicator with their fancy packages and the shrink wrap and all that. The bad news is that at this point, Kelly and I still need to work on the online store to sell it. We were going to talk about that while I was down in Austin, but, you know, for some reason we didn't get around to it. Something about the, you know, the IPAs and the Mexican food again. So, check basicbrewing.com and see if it's available online. If it's not, check back in a couple of days. I will be offering a bundling discount, so you can buy both of our DVDs at a reduced price, so you'll want to check that out. Okay. On to our panel of experts in Austin and Brian Warren's Hot Side Aeration Experiment. Brian and his brewing buddy John brewed a beer and abused it to see if they could affect the taste of the finished beer. We gathered at Austin Homebrew Supply to taste the samples, and we got some surprising results. Okay, today we are in the back of Austin Homebrew Supply in Austin, Texas. And today's going to be the day where Brian, we get to see his the results of his hot side aeration experiment, at least so far. And joining us, Brian, introduce yourself and what you do and where you're from.
I'm Brian Warren from Inglewood, Colorado. I'm a graphic designer, not that that's really relevant to brewing, but I've been brewing for about 2 years now. And you may remember me from the International Mead Festival episode and also the Four Blind Mice episode.
And you're not wearing a kilt this time. I'm kind of disappointed.
If only you had told me, James, I would have brought it.
He wore a kilt to the Mead Festival. And also joining us, Chris.
I'm Chris Colby. I'm the editor of BYO and also a member of the Austin Zealots Homebrew Club.
Along with Charles, who's also here.
Yes, I'm Charles Culp. I work at Austin Homebrew Supply, and I'm Austin Zealot as well.
All right. And what we're going to do is test Brian's experiment on hot side aeration, but maybe before we get into the details of the experiment, Chris, you can give us some background on what exactly hot side aeration is.
Well, basically, in the production of beer, you want to only want to aerate at one point. Generally, you make your wort, you cool it down, and you'd like to aerate it immediately before you pitch the yeast and fermentation begins. And this is in order to supply the yeast with oxygen in order to build sterols so they can make healthy cell walls. Aeration at other times typically leads to off flavors. And one of the types of aeration that people have been worried about in the past is called hot side aeration, which is, as the name implies, aeration of either wort or mash or anything on the hot side of brewing leading up to, fermentation. The idea with this is that the aeration leads to oxidation of wort components, which then later show themselves as off flavors. In George Fix's book, he points out a couple different kinds of problems, and I'm just going to take a
quoting from the text.
Yeah, so I don't mess it up. He basically mentions two kinds. The first is a German word that I'm probably going to mangle horrifically, but it looks to me like it would be Herbststoffe. And the idea here is that phenols in the wort are oxidized during wort production, and these create off flavors later. He notes specifically that it's a grain astringent kind of flavor and might have a metallic edge to it as well. A second problem is one that's called it's called oxidation without molecular oxygen. The idea is that melanoidins get oxidized, and then they in turn oxidize alcohols later in the process. So the basic idea is if you introduce air to beer or wort when it's hot, off flavors will show up later.
And at least in your mind, Brian, hot side aeration is a controversial issue, right? Or what led you to do this experiment?
Well, it's kind of funny because it started with a batch I was doing with my good buddy John. This was probably about 6 months ago. It was the first time I brewed with him. And we were getting to, I believe it was the loudering point of the brew, and I was kind of splashing it around a little bit. And he's like, oh, hot side aeration. And I'm like, what's that? And he said, it's bad. It could make it taste bad. And I said, okay, fine. So we brewed again about a month later, and we got to the loudering point. And I was like, ooh, got to be careful, hot side aeration. He said, oh, I read on some message board that it's a myth. Never mind, forget it. I'm like, okay, fine. So that was kind of the very scientific process that I went through of developing my opinion that it might be a myth. And so we were brewing. I think it was the Four Blind Mice brew with Casey and Jason. And it kind of came up. Like, Casey was a little bit nervous about it. And I said, "Oh, you mean the myth of hot side aeration? Of course, yes. We're all worried about that, aren't we?"
And Casey's a little uptight about the hot side aeration issue.
He uses brewing as a very wonderful way for him to just have a lot of control over the process, and he enjoys it a lot, and more power to him.
So oftentimes in brewing, I think that you know, we follow these rules, and we kind of take them for granted, and we don't do these kinds of experiments. I mean, do you guys think that this is the case, or do you find that?
Well, I do, I don't know, a reasonable amount of experiments at home. Just a lot of them aren't, you know, set up strictly as a scientific experiment, more just trying this and that. And, I mean, I think this is a good idea because this is, in homebrewing, there is a controversy over this. And a lot of people go to, you know, supreme lengths to, you know, minimize any splashing or whatever that, you know, in their brewing. And it's kind of interesting. I talked to Ashton Lewis. He's the brewer at Springfield Brewing. He's also the technical editor of BYO and the Mr. Wizard for us. And this was like when I first started working there, and I started, you know, I asked him about what did he think of hot side aeration. And his comment was basically, on a homebrew scale, you'd have, with the tools we have and the scale that we brew at, you'd really have to go out of your way to just, you know, beat the crap out of your mash, if I can say beat the crap out of your mash
sure.
on a podcast. You know, you'd really have to abuse your mash or really have to foam up your, you know, wort when you're cooling it or something to get an appreciable effect. Mm-hmm. You know, like commercial brewers, they might pump hot wort into a tank and it might fall six stories down a conical fermenter. And, you know, with all the equipment they have and the scale they brew at, they might be able to manage hot side aeration. But he didn't think at a homebrew scale it was worth worrying about, and he certainly didn't think that sweating the little stuff, like if you're transferring your mash to your lauter tun and, you know, you just sort of slop it in there, you know, that little bit, or if you're just splashing around, you know, it's not like a couple bubbles show up in your wort at some point and, you know, the whole batch is wrecked. So it'll be interesting to see.
Charles, you're nodding your head. You seem to agree with that.
Oh, yeah, and that's what I heard that George Fix believed too, that on a homebrew level we'd really have to try hard to get the oxygen into the wort. But still, I try not to splash my wort from my mash tun to into my kettle. You know, it's just good practice.
But talking about really abusing your wort, you really abused the wort. Tell us about the experiment, Brian. How it was set up and how you went about doing it.
Well, we did try to kind of operate on a bit of extremes here because we knew that the general consensus by the professionals was that on a large scale, yes, it's possible to create hot side aeration, but how far would you have to go on a homebrew scale to really cause problems? And so here's the way that we basically set up the experiment. We brewed a regular kind of pale ale, and that was how we developed the recipe, and it was just a 2-gallon recipe. So a little bit kind of like your six-pack IPA, but a little bit bigger than that. And so what we did was after we did our mash, we loutered, and there we had some reasonably hot wort. And we split it into two batches at that point. And we took this kind of really wild-looking whisk and just kind of whisked up the whole beer, and or the, I guess it was wort at that point, or is it? And we just kind of, by the end of that, it kind of looked like a beer cappuccino. And so we knew we had done a pretty good job there. And so we boiled both batches in the same brew kettle, trying to keep as much consistent as possible between the two at that point. And then after both boils, we split it up again. And at that point, you know, we had one that was aerated before the boil and one that wasn't. And after splitting those, we aerated two of the now half-gallon batches. And so at the end of that, after the boil, at the end of that, we had one that was not aerated at all, one that was aerated before the boil but not after the boil, one that was aerated not before the boil but after the boil, and one that was aerated at both times possible.
One that you beat the crap out of, essentially.
Yes. The horribly abused one. And then we cooled everything, put it into little growlers as our fermenters, and put airlocks on everything, and then waited a few weeks. And after that, we bottled, and here we are today.
So there we go. Does that sound, that sounds like a pretty scientific way of doing things, don't you guys think?
Well, I think if you... You know, if you really abuse the wort at a few different places, and we taste a beer that there's none of, you know, there's been no wort abuse, we should be able to tell a difference, I would think.
Yeah, I would think so too.
Predictions?
speculation. I don't know. And I'd be afraid that I decide that I taste that flavor, but I say this flavor is going to be there.
Very good. Yeah. Keep an open mind. That's an excellent approach.
I'll guess the differences are minimal.
Yeah. Very good. Brian, do you want to predict anything?
I am. Well, I'm on the microphone right now, so I will predict that yes, but I'm not going to tell you what I mean.
Okay. Well, should we take a pause and pour the first sample, and then we'll come back.
Sure.
Okay. We're going to start off with the control.
This is the control group.
Tasty. First impressions?
Pretty clean. I don't really taste any of the, you know, sort of standard oxidative characters. There's no. I don't detect any cardboardiness in the nose or any sherry flavors.
Yeah, I don't detect any problems. It's a straight ahead beer. Tasty.
That's good. So, where would you classify the style, just for reference sake?
Oh, I don't know.
Ballpark.
An fresh, ale.
Fresh bitter.
Something needing more hops.
Well, I should say, you know. We didn't want to put too many hops in it for the basic reason of, you know, you don't want to ruin your palate. But.
Good cover there, Brian. Way to go. Okay, we've established that is a, Charles is saying, blonde ale. Nice and light in color. Very clean.
Smells good. It's got a nice malty
nose to it.
Okay. That was not too dramatic. So now we'll move on to our second sample. Brian is pouring the second one, and it really wanted to get out of there. Foamed up quite a bit. Of course, it made the trip from Colorado this morning. So Chris is he's already had his nose in the cup. Wow, what are we picking up there?
I'm getting some sourness. I'm wondering if it's contaminated. I mean, I don't know.
It's infected.
With the way it bubbled out of the. I don't think oxidation would do that. And there's a sour edge to it, and there's a definite funk in the that I don't think you can attribute to oxidation.
But there is an astringency at the end. But
Who knows what you can attribute that to?
Yeah. Well.
Possibly outside aeration, but
we have our scapegoat for the conversation. If anything's bad, well, it must have been the outside aeration.
Well, there's definitely.
I catch it more on the aroma than anything else.
Yeah, I agree. I wish we had our flavor active beer kit here. We could pop in one of those capsules and.
But I do catch an astringency at the very end. Just kind of a bitterness.
It definitely tastes different from the first one.
Yeah.
But it could be because you guys are saying maybe because of an infection, because also the beer foamed up, whereas the first one didn't.
Right. nobody's ever hypothesized that, you know, a side effect of hot cider aeration would be sourness. And given that it also foamed over, I think this is just a contaminated sample.
Brian, you wash your bottles. You did remember to wash the bottle, right?
I didn't bottle this.
Oh. So Brian has a scapegoat.
Yeah.
Okay, so inconclusive on the second sample.
Right.
And we'll move on to the third. It definitely smells different than the second one. What do you guys think?
It's a little fruitier.
Yeah, definitely. But clean. I don't taste any problems.
But I agree that the flavor profile is a bit fruitier.
Now, we did use the same yeast for all of them, but the yeast could have been a little more excited in this. We used the same starter, too, so I don't know.
And the same fermentation temperatures and the same...
Same basement, same equal-sized growlers.
The malt tastes a little different in these two. I don't really know if one's... You would say it's better or worse, or... I'm not really picking up any of the classic, like, notes of oxidation in this one, but there's a different character. I mean, the first one tastes more like sort of rough, like not in a negative way, but in a good ale way. You know, it's a flavorful, and this is maybe a little more rounded. The oxidized one. I mean, it's hard to put it into words that really describe what I'm tasting, but there is a difference in the malt character.
Do you think so?
Yes, I agree. Got nothing to add, though.
What he said.
What the editor said. Well, I'm going to taste the first one again to kind of get a baseline again.
It's interesting because it's fruitier. Maybe that's the roundness, but it's not like Belgian triple fruity or anything.
No,
it's not estery. It's not floral. I don't know.
I actually prefer sample number three to sample number one. It's got more character. It's got more flavor. Would you agree, Charles?
Yeah, I do agree.
Okay.
It's also clear.
Seems to be clear.
Yeah, the second sample... In looking in my cup, we have white plastic cups. We don't have clear cups. But looking from the top, and I think they have the same level in there, the second sample, the funky one, is a little lighter in my cup, looks like.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know what happened there.
Some schlunk in the bottom.
Yeah. It's chunky style.
I wonder if that was towards the end of the bottling for that one, in that batch.
Colors can get scrubbed from wort, and I mean, if you had a contaminating microorganism in addition to the beer yeast, that might be taking some of the color out of the second one.
It's possible.
A lot of lambics end up very very blonde, and I mean, a lot of that is the choice of the malt bill. But I mean, the lambic fermentation, you know, gets worked really hard. You know, every organism in the planet is in there, you know, chugging away, and so. You know, that might be a little bit of an explanation for the color differences here.
So you accidentally made a Belgian. Okay, we'll go on to number four.
How old are these beers?
Yeah, it's a good question. How old are these beers?
They were bottled 2 to 3 weeks ago.
So still fairly young.
Some of the flavors that reputedly come from hot side oxidation or hot side aeration don't show up until later. So, I mean, if you could repeat the experiment several months down the road, and, like, I don't know if you have extra bottles of these.
We do.
But
yeah, this was kind of tasting one out of more that we plan on. this may be a good time to talk about it, but you talk about how over time the stuff becomes more pronounced, the off flavors, and particularly if the aging wasn't done under ideal conditions, you know, possibly being left out in the sun or bad, you know, really warm temperatures or some of those kinds of things. And so we've thought that it might be kind of fun to purposefully age poorly some of the samples, too, to kind of see if that really does make the stuff more pronounced.
Yeah, that should bring it out. I mean, if you age it badly, you know, warm, and whatever differences are there, that should really, you know, accentuate them.
So now we're on sample four. Hmm, that's different again.
This is fruity like the third one.
It sure is, and Charles made a face.
He's
still making a face.
Put that face into words.
Yeah,
Charles.
Yeah. Explain that face, Charles. What do you smell?
Getting kind of a metallic, something metallic in the nose.
Yeah, there's a metallic.
It's kind of a higher alcohol, possibly maybe too.
Like a malt liquor or something like a. Not that I drink that.
Not necessarily high alcohol. I mean like a phenol alcohol. A fusel alcohol, excuse me.
Oh. Yeah, this one's fruity, sort of like number three, but it's a little bit more. And there is almost, I don't know if it's fusel, but something like that. There's a solventy, fusely kind of edge to the fruitiness.
Solvent.
Definitely.
Is it kind of grapeish? Do you smell grapes? I'm trying to put a... Or apples.
I can get apples out of there.
Like a white grape juice or something like that. And it kind of reminds me of this website I read about how to make prison wine.
Have you got some plans? Is that a contingency plan?
It is a contingency plan. In some states, they don't allow you to homebrew. So.
Well... In Utah, allegedly, they don't homebrew, but they sell my DVDs in the homebrew shop there. So, wow, now that's considerably more fruity than even the third, isn't it?
Yes, definitely.
And it,
which is a little weird because it's not one of the predictions that hot cideration leads to, you know, an abundance of fruity esters. So. It's kind of it's an interesting result, but one that, you know, we'll have to think about how we want to interpret that. If it's, possibly differences in the fermentation, or if, you know, maybe it does lead to a more fruity beer.
And of course, it is young, so
that's a good point.
It will develop. I think this one will develop really. I'm not going to say nicely, but it'll develop.
Yeah, that is a good point. These are going to dry out probably as time goes on. So a lot of the fruitiness will abate. Now, Brian, are you ready to tell us which samples we tasted, how the crap was beaten out of each of these samples?
Sure. As you can probably guess, the last one was the one that got beaten the most.
And again, Charles is making faces.
I know. I almost want to feed him more of it just so I can watch.
I think that's your water over there, Charles, way over there.
The first one was the one that was aerated. I kind of remember because I almost mixed him up here. The one that was aerated second, not first. The one that was aerated after the boil, but not before it. And the third one was the one that was aerated before the boil.
Interesting.
I think. Uh-oh. I'm holding that here. That's right.
Okay. And then the last one was the one that got both treatments.
Right. And that's the one that we noticed the most stuff going on there.
Interesting.
Very interesting. I mean, it could be, in Fix's book, one of the things he mentions with regard to hot cideration is that things get oxidized, and then molecules subsequently go on and oxidize other molecules. Maybe the extreme, you know, level of oxidation that you introduced in this, maybe esters and aldehydes and all these kind of things got oxidized to the point that we are picking it up in this experiment. Because, I mean, the difference between these beers are not subtle at all. I mean, at the beginning, I predicted that we wouldn't see much difference. But, I mean, if you can't taste and smell a difference between these beers, You just have no nose or taste buds. I mean, it's not subtle at all. There's a huge, huge difference here.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I guess this may be evidence to prove that you shouldn't beat the crap out of your beer. But is it evidence that you should worry too much about hot side aeration? I don't know. What do you guys think?
That would take another experiment. I mean, clearly from the results of these, it would seem to indicate that at a homebrew scale, you can go out of your way and induce negative effects to hot side aeration, or induce negative effects in your beer through hot side aeration. But, if smaller, subtle amounts of splashing, subtle amounts of slopping, your grain into the lauter tun or whatever, whether that's going to lead to off flavors would take another experiment.
But obviously, all these three beers taste like three different beers, or four actually with the control, four different beers, and the difference being how the wort was, handled. So obviously there's something in handling the wort correctly.
What I would like to see is something as subtle as completing your fermentation with a single stage in the primary and bottling from that, and doing a racking to a secondary and then bottling from that and examining, comparing those two, because that's generally the level that we talk about. We're not taking whisks out and beating the crap out of our wort when we're brewing. We're trying to be as careful as possible. So that would be the interesting experiment to do next, maybe.
Sure, but I mean, racking the secondary, I mean, you leave all the old yeast behind. I mean, there's all these other reasons that it might be a good idea, or it might change the flavor of your beer, regardless of the amount of oxidation that you would induce on your beer. So you would almost have to turn it into three things. One that you would maybe not be so careful about when you rack in a secondary, and one that you are super careful and, you try not to do anything that would give any oxidation to, and then the other one that you just don't rack at all.
That's true. It's important, as they teach us in science, to, when you're doing an experiment, to change only one variable in the equation so that you're testing for that one variable. And I think that you did that nicely with this experiment.
Well, I got to hand it to John. I mean, he's the one who developed the whole idea. It was one of your earlier podcasts that one of your listeners wrote in saying that it was about the sanitation episode, talking about iodophore and how they... at one point, they split up their batch, and they had sanitized some of their bottles with iodophore and some without, and nobody noticed the difference. And so I thought, oh, that would be a great way to try to do the hot side aeration episode. So I told my buddy John about it, and like 2 minutes later, he wrote an email back to me with all the information. Okay, here's how we'll do it, and here's when we'll split up the batches, and here's exactly how it's going to work. And I'm like, I picked the right guy to brew with for this one.
Well, thanks, John. And what's John's last name?
Holder.
Or does he want his last name?
I don't think he minds. It's Holder, John Holder.
Well, thanks, John. Any last comments? Any closing thoughts?
I was a little surprised by the results of this. I didn't think the differences would be that great. And when I first tasted the overly fruity ones, or the second ones, at first I sort of thought, well, maybe it's just these fermented a little warmer or whatever. But, I mean, in order to bring out this level of fruitiness, these would have had to ferment a lot warmer than these. And I'm assuming they sort of all fermented side by side in the same with... Yeah, it's very interesting because these... I've never heard anyone claim that hot side aeration leads to fruity, solventy kind of flavors. And they're clearly present in these beers that have been abused.
Also, I'd be interested to see the next tasting, how it's going to develop. Because clearly the last sample, the one that got the crap beat out of it, had, this metallic thing going on. And also, I detected less, there's some fruitiness, but less character. Yeah, it just, it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see how it turns out, but I'm glad I'm not going to have to taste it.
Me too.
Me too.
The last sample definitely did taste the least amount like the first one, the least like the, you know, pale ale, kind of just normal beer.
The first one tastes very much like just a normal straight ahead, you know, homebrewed ale, you know, good straight ahead beer. These later ones, progressively, you know, not Belgian funky, but there's just more fruit. There's more sort of little solventy edges to it. And then the last one is just, there's something going on there.
Well, very good. Well, thank you all. I want to thank you all for taking part in the experiment. And thank you, Charles and Forrest, for letting us use the Austin Homebrew Supply Store as the base. And thanks, Chris, for supplying the Scottish Ale as the warm-up beer. Nothing wrong with that beer. We can
no hot side aeration there.
No. Very nice. Well, thanks, everybody.
Of course, I realize now that I forgot to thank Brian Warren in person for all his work on the experiment, and also his friend John. So thanks, guys, for helping out with coming up with the idea to do this experiment. And, boy, it was interesting to taste those samples. And also thanks again to Chris Colby and Charles Culp, and also thanks to Forrest Rognes, owner of the Austin Homebrew Supply Store, for letting us take over his back room. Also, I want to say thanks to Jennifer and Teresa, Chris and Charles's better halves, for being our live studio audience during the recording. We all went out for beers and food at a local brew pub afterwards, and only then did I realize that Jennifer and Teresa were also beer enthusiasts. If I had realized this before we recorded the show, I would have included them in the tasting. So shame on me for making assumptions based on gender. You know, I guess I'm not used to being around women of good taste. So that's it. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say hey, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. And if you wanted to get into home brewing while you're on our site, you can check out our DVDs. In Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process step by step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVD on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online from us. And if your local homebrew store doesn't carry our DVDs, maybe you can suggest that they can contact me to find out how they can do that. Well, that's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. And while in Austin, Texas, the host of Basic Brewing Radio stays on Kelly's couch. So, Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time. So long.